Okay, so there are still some people are missing, but due to the time constraint, I would like to start again. So, and we go to the topic two. It's identifying separate performance obligations. So you have already known what is proposed under ED. So, do you have any views or on this point? Nothing? Okay, so we should go to okay, so Kathleen.
Our international view on this one is that we're finding the distinct profit margin quite problematic, and that isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all of recognizing separate components. And so it is a difficult judgmental area, but we really found that the profit margin just made it even more so, and that without that, it was easier to get to some sort of an understanding as to what we're looking for, even though it may vary in different facts and circumstances.
So you mean in practice, to have a distinct margin, say in practice, it's not the realistic.
It's not helpful. I mean, I think particularly this is a technology point, so we're moving completely away from the industry we were talking about before the break. But if you think about a lot of products that come from intellectual property, so you have a team of designers and they work on a certain thing, then they work on the upgrade. Okay, where's the distinct profit margin on this and how does it all work? And it's really, you're creating something extra off a common base, and that profit margin doesn't help and it could hinder.
Sorry, can I just up there? I know the distinct profit margin has tripped a lot of people up and they struggle with that notion. Do you struggle with, if you ignore that phrase, distinct profit margin, and look at what we put behind it about the distinct risks and the resources, do you find those troublesome sort of features in trying to decide whether you're going to sort of separate performance obligations?
Yes, I mean, in terms of the examples as well, there was a construction example where there was just this mixture of, are we describing facts or are we explaining how they link to things? So it was simply, well, they decided there are different risks, so we've got these different components in a construction contract that was not easy to get your head around. Well, what are we really talking about here? And it seemed to add to the complications rather than helping.
Thank you. So, Dr. Yap, please.
I do have a little bit of problem with the paragraph 23. I think the implications that I have from this paragraph is that too much emphasis on whether the entity or other entity or have to say about how to separate the performance obligations. To me, I think it should be entity-specific rather than depending on what your counterparts, your competitors are doing. I think there's too much emphasis on that. And I have no problem in for using other entities or your competitors as a benchmark, as a guide. However, I think the standard should not rule out that what is the business model of the entity, of that entity. I think too much emphasis on what other people think. What about your own business model? I think there's a paragraph 23 that indicates that you look at what other people do. But to me, this is my business model, and why should I look at what you do to decide what to separate and what not to? So I think the emphasis is too much on what other people do. Again, it's the activity of my company, it's not what you do, even though you are my competitor who is selling the same products. But I'm sure the two companies will definitely have different business model altogether. And then the business model should guide the separation to some extent over here. And then another clarification that I need is the example 11 used in your ED, because I can't see how so-called the what it is. The example 11, how the finishing site and the preparation site are distinct from each other. In example 11, that you try to demonstrate the impact of paragraph 23b2, that the because it's say in your example, that the site preparation and site finishing should be regarded as different from other contract activities. And it's not clearly explained why they are so-called distinct from other activities. So I'd just like to seek some clarification on that, because as far as I think, in my view, I think the cost of the services, I think in many aspects, can be separately identified, the costs specifically related to that particular service. So I think the example 11 needs some clarification regarding the site finishing and the site preparation are two distinct so-called performances or activities from the rest. But this is not clear in example 11 to me. Perhaps it could be my English problem.
No, I don't think so, but thank you very much. So, and any reaction from staff?
No, I think in that example, what we were trying to illustrate was the sort of that you couldn't unbundle, separate the highly interrelated tasks, and therefore the sort of core construction activity, the contract management service sort of bound all of those activities together into a single performance obligation, whereas with the preparation and the finishing, you didn't have that sort of contract management services sort of overriding those activities. But I think it comes back to what Catherine was saying a moment ago, and sort of saying that distinct risk notion, I think some people have made similar comments to yourself on this example, saying it's not clear enough exactly why those two activities get separated. But the thinking is to sort of say that they didn't sort of share the risks with the other activities, and therefore they weren't so highly interrelated, and therefore they could be separated.
They are not sharing the same common control, like what you say, that from the management contract.
I think it's the idea that the contract management service there doesn't bind those activities together with all of the other activities in the contract.
In that case, that was the case, I think it should be clearly indicated in the example.
Okay, thank you. So, Swat Chan, please.
Thanks, Tazumi. I share Kim's view in that I think only an entity's business should be considered, and obviously also the entity's business model. I mean, just give you an example. If I'm a telco, and as part of my promotional event, say I give a customer a free television for every sign up, whether you recontract or it's a new contract, the question then is, would it be useful information for the users for the telco to actually show television as one of its revenue item, sale of television? I don't think so. I don't think that's going to be relevant to the users, which is why I think that only an entity's own business as well as its business model should be considered. And I think this is consistent with paragraph 20 of the ED as well, which says that which basically requires an entity to evaluate the terms of the contract and its customary business practice. So you're just looking at your own contract and your own business practice, not so much the other parties. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Catherine, please.
I would like to disagree with that point of view in terms of the television example. I mean, just to give an extreme alternative example, in Hong Kong, McDonald's, and they probably do this elsewhere, do a whole sort of buy a Happy Meal and you get a certain collectible. And I have seen people queuing up outside McDonald's every morning for a month. They buy the food, they put it in the bin, and they get the collectible. Now, the business model for McDonald's is selling hamburgers. Apparently, it's not selling Snoopies. But at the end of the day, they got some revenue, they gave some product, and why the customer was there, which one drove the transaction, is not immediately clear. So, I mean, a little facetious example, but I think the basic principle is that if somebody offers you a free TV for signing up for a phone contract, in their minds, they're buying a TV and a phone contract, and that would be the principle. But I would say we in terms of how you actually distinguish these sort of things, it's more the bundles of goods and services, I think, that will cause us some problems. We've had examples of, for instance, wind farms, where you have a supplier of wind turbines who delivers the wind turbines then sets them into concrete, erects them, and at some point later tests the whole field of wind turbines. And the question was, when do you recognize revenue? And obviously we were doing this under IS 18. Do you recognize only once the installation has happened? Do you have to wait for the further testing? Does it matter that you're pretty confident the product will work and that the testing is just routine? Should you recognize on delivery? Because let's face it, the installation, it adds to the product, but maybe other people could do it. Or looking at this ED, it seems like even if it's only us that can do it, still you say, well, I could sell that service separately to somebody else if they came along and bought different wind turbines. I know how to put them in. So is that enough to say delivery gets you revenue on the turbines, the installation is a separate service? So whole sort of bundles of goods and services, and to what extent they're distinct is where we think some of the problems will lie.
Thank you. Yes, Tadashi, please. Yes.
Yeah, I also disagree with that. The first two commentators on take into consideration on only the entity perspective. I agree with Catherine and the existing the exposure draft that preparer should look at what the other business doing that, because the entity can binding any services, any product in it. And that's in the case of the other businesses selling in the separately, provide the service separately, the entity have to consider that the fact that they distinct the performance obligation separately.
Okay, thank you. So, Dr. Yao, please.
I think follow up what Catherine say, I think we need to look at the substance of the arrangement. You know, in substance, that it's really a two separate activities or not, rather than just giving a very bright line to say what is and what isn't. Like, for example, that like if I'm going to supply to you item A and item B, and I tell you that unless you, if you did not get either of the items, you can get the refund. Then in that case, will that be item A and B are two separate activities or they are combined? Right, so I think we really need, to me, in that example I just gave, it should be combined, you know, and not separate. And therefore, we really need to look at the substance of the arrangement, and this should be emphasized in the final standard.
Yeah, thank you very much. So I think that you would like to spend more time on in topic three. So if you do not want to say anything more, we would like to go to topic three. Is that okay? Yes, so now topic three is a measurement of revenue. So the point is already been on your paper, so I would like to seek your views. Do you have any views? Oh, yes, please.
The method of reflecting credit risk on the measurement of revenue has, I think, a great similarity with the expected loss model of IS 39 financial statements. Because the credit risk will be reflected at the initial time of contract, at the stage of the recognition of revenue, the credit risk is reflected. In that sense, I think expected loss model of the financial statement and this notion of reflecting credit risk on the revenue is the same, I think. But the expected loss model in the financial statement has many discussions exposed draft, but this exposed draft does not provide the detailed basis of the credit risk treatment, I think. So it's needed to include the basis of why the credit risk should be reflected in the recognition of revenue.
Yeah, thank you very much. So as long as I understand, our current IS-18 treatment is exactly the same as it is proposed. That means collectability should be reflected when you recognize as revenue. So that is my understanding. And then that revenue, once it is revenue is recognized, and the contract asset is now turned to receivables, and then receivables, I think at inception, credit risk has already been taken away. So and then, so that means that it becomes very clean when you recognize as receivables. Yeah, that is my understanding. If my understanding is wrong, Henry, you can correct me. Okay, I think. Yeah, Catherine?
I don't want to say that your understanding is wrong, but in terms of the current IS-18, I think we use credit risk as a hurdle as to whether or not we recognize revenue from, or the timing, if you like, of the revenue recognition. So we don't preclude the revenue recognition. We defer the timing of when we think we've made a sale until we're comfortable. Now, the question of what do we mean by comfortable, and I think the word in the standard is probable. So generally, a more likely than not threshold, at least some people may set it a bit higher. So it's a hurdle approach to the recognition of revenue, and that is the approach that we're asking to carry forward in the ED, but we don't see it at the moment in the ED. We see more of an emphasis on simply taking a large population of items, doing some sort of a weighted average approach, and bringing in a revenue number on that basis. So we would like to see a greater focus on the amount of revenue is basically the collections from customers, other than that which is called interest income. And if the collection doesn't come in straight away, it comes in a little bit later, it's still a collection from customers. It's not somehow something that affects your measurement of receivables and goes through as sort of interest income or negative interest income or whatever, or losses going through. So we would like, I think, in essence, a continuation of what we see is already in IS-18.
So can I ask clarification? So what you have pointed out is you don't like our approach and the proposal, or just you mentioned about the difference between the 18 and this proposal?
It's both. We see a difference. We like the existing approach in IS-18, so we see that revenue should be recognized on a hurdle basis, and also that if the revenue comes in later, it would still be an adjustment to the revenue line. It wouldn't be, as you described, being something to do with financial assets.
So, Henry?
But if I understood correctly, once you've got through a hurdle, if there was any risk there, you would factor that into the measurement of revenue. So it's sort of you want a hurdle, and then also having recognized revenue, subsequent changes should also flow through the revenue line. So it's sort of those two aspects of it.
Yeah. And a point in terms of the estimate that we're talking about here, if you've got a large population of items, then probability weighted is a reasonable approach. But it's not the principle. It's a method of arriving at a best estimate for a large population. And if the population isn't large, then we wouldn't like to see probability weighted being the only way to measure things.
Thank you. So, yes, Dr. Yap, please.
Yeah, I would like to echo what Christine said about the weighted average method. Actually, according to paragraph of 43 of the ED, it requires the entity to reduce the amount of promised consideration to reflect the customer credit risk. To me, credit risk is part of the risk management function. Again, I just want to go back to what I said this morning in relation to topic one on the control. What are we reporting? The revenue is what information is projecting to the users? Relevant information. What is relevant to the users? Okay? And I try to struggle with this because on one hand is a credit risk, and credit risk to me is part of the function, the major function of risk management. Therefore, if I were the shareholders, what are the investors? I want to look at the revenue. You see, revenue is a top line figure to reflect the management ability to generate sales, then if the collection is a problem, then it should go to the other line, which is the middle line at an expense, in a sense that it clearly indicates to me that which department is doing a good job. Is it the sales or the collection department? So to me, that is go down to the micro level. At the macro level, I think we must be very clear, or rather, I speak to made up his mind, that what are you trying to depict, the information, what information that you try to depict from the revenue, which is the top line figure. If you start taking off everything from the top line, then what is the role of the middle line? What is the role of middle line? Promotion, the issue about the warranty. What's the difference between a promotion cost to warranty? Because warranty got to deduct straight away from the revenue, whereas promotion cost is an expense. So I think the line to define which one to be deducted on top line or to be put as an expense in the middle line, in the middle part of the comprehensive income, statements of comprehensive income, is not very clear. That's all. I think we need to be really clear about what are we trying to depict in terms of the information coming up from the revenue, which is the top line.
Okay, I understand your point, but say what is proposed here is as I explained to you that it's based on the current IS 18. Say that line of thinking is still succeeded in the exposure draft, and what you have proposed is a transaction, sort of the contracted price should come to the top line, and then the expected uncollectability should be recognized as expense. So it's a sort of the gross up notion. I understand that way of thinking, but say my understanding is this proposal is in line with what is said in IS 18, I think. Yeah, thank you. Amy, please.
I think credit risk should not be reflected in amount of revenue, because the effects of customer credit risk would be different accounted for before and after the entity has obtained unconditional right to consideration. When in the case the entity recognizes receivable, subsequent change recognizes as income or expense other than revenue. However, in the case entity recognizes contractual asset, subsequent changes recognized as revenue, so it's inconsistent.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. So I understand. So what you have said is in line with what Dr. Yap said. So always the uncollectability should be recognized as part of expense. Okay. Thank you. Do you have any other views? Okay, Tadashi, please.
I'm sorry to say I have a different view on that, the collectability, because collectability is only being taken account in conjunction with time value, I think, practically. Because if the entity should consider the uncollectability is because they receive the cash in rare to the revenue recognition, that in other words the entity should consider the time valuable money, and also that the issue is the time value money, in other words the discount rate includes the risk portion of the customer or the risk free rate. I think that time value money in this case should reflect the customer's credit risk in that sense. The uncollectability does not taking a stand alone, because any time it should be considered in conjunction with the time value of money.
It's not clear to me. So the uncollectability should be reflected to the discount rate? That is what you have said?
If I understand correctly, the exposure direct, the uncollectability, the entity why the entity considers it current collectability, it means that their revenue recognize revenue, but they collect money later. And then at that case, the entity should also consider the time value of money. And then the issue, the uncollectability, is cross-connected to that, the discount rate. So that the issue is discount rate should be a risk-free rate, or discount rate should be the risk-adjusted, customer risk, credit risk-adjusted discount rate. That I support is discount rate should be reflect the credit risk of the customer.
Okay, so I think if I understand correctly, so the credit risk could be reflected in two ways. One is to reflect the actual cash flow estimations, and the other way is to reflect to the discount rate. So, and you're just suggesting it should be reflected to the discount rate. So that means that in any case, you are supporting to recognize the uncollectability as part of the revenue recognition, it seems to me.
I supported the AD position that.
Thank you. So, yes, Millie, please.
I agree that the credit risk should be included in measurement of revenue because typically the businessman, when he prices his goods and services, the expected credit risk will be taken into account in how much he expects to get from that particular sale. So I agree with the ED.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, it's quite unusual to have such a support. Yes, please.
I just want to make a very short comment. Between the gross approach and net approach, I think we have to select the gross approach. I believe the gross approach provides more information to the users. That's all.
Okay, thank you very much. So, is there any reaction from staff? No?
Well, just to add that I think that the mixed views here today are very reflective of what we're hearing everywhere, that some people agree with capturing the credit risk in the measurement of revenue, but I think most people who support that idea would like Catherine's approach of that subsequent changes should also flow through the revenue line as well, so that if you collect additional consideration from the customer, that gets reported as revenue. And then the other view that we're hearing is that the effects of collectability should be kept out of the revenue line and reported separately, on the argument that provides more useful information. So I think we've got two steers there that we'll have to reconsider in redeliberation.
Okay, so thank you very much. If you have no other... Oh, yes, please.
Thanks. I just like to find out, for the probability recognition criterion, I understand that ISB has received a lot of response on the re-exposure of IAS 37, and apparently there were a lot of disagreement with the shifting of that probability from recognition to measurement. And I'd just like to understand from ISB, how would that actually interact with what you are suggesting here? Because what you're suggesting here is really the same thing, moving it from recognition to measurement. I just like to get a sense of where exactly are we moving.
Right, so you're talking about the relationship between the IAS 37 and this recognition of the performance obligation?
And the recognition of a receivable of an asset.
Oh, right, okay.
Revenue and asset. Because, under the current, as Catherine has pointed out, under the current IAS 18, there is a hurdle. You need to meet that hurdle before you recognize revenue. And now we are removing that hurdle.
Yeah. Okay, so, Henry?
I think what I can sort of say is that we actually spent a lot of time talking about probability-weighted measurements of revenue last week in Norwalk. It was one of the key aspects of the discussion, really. And my takeaway was that there certain people feel that when you've got very low probabilities So suppose you've got a binary outcome with a 20% chance of getting some additional consideration and an 80% chance of getting nothing, that in that situation a lot of people think that you do need a sort of some sort of a hurdle to get through before you start recognizing uncertain consideration. So we'll undoubtedly be looking at that. I think the other key takeaway, and this is very much reflected in the comment letters, is that a lot of people do not like the probability-weighted approach when you move away from homogeneous portfolios of transactions, and have sort of advocated sort of best estimate approaches. And I think, but what we were exploring last week was what does best estimate really mean? And we were trying to get at this notion, is that still a sort of probability-weighted approach, but you don't have to go hunting for lots of different scenarios? So I think those are sort of various things that we're going to have to consider in the redeliberation.
But I think we're talking about two different things here. One, it's really moving the probability, you know, from recognition to measurement. And if you moved it to measurement, then, you know, how do you measure that? In weighted, probability weighted average approach, is the approach that it's articulated in the ED. But I just would like to know, because this is actually also a conceptual framework project, whether the probability should kick in before you even recognize an asset, or before you even recognize a revenue.
Okay, so, yeah, Paul.
Actually, my point is pretty much what you just said. It really is a conceptual, it comes back to our conceptual framework. Right now, our criteria for recognition of assets and liabilities both have a probability threshold. It's Catherine's two-step approach versus one. The direction the board has been moving, it seems to me, and I'm new on the board, but I see that articulated in the IAS 37 project, is probability should not be a recognition condition, but should enter into measurement. But we're getting pushback on that, both on the IAS 37 project and here. So I don't know where the board might end up, but you're absolutely right. It's a conceptual issue that we've got to face up to, really, in our elements project, which is now sort of a bit back burner, and it will certainly not be resolved before this one, and IAS 37 is up in the air where that's going.
Yeah, thank you. I'm an old board member, but...
Very.
Yeah, so I support what he explained to you. I think that we have a struggle with the sort of the cash inflow or cash outflow possibility should not reflect to the recognition criteria. It should be taken into account in the measurement. So that is a clear message under 37. So, but obviously we will restart the 37 discussion. So, and maybe next year we will issue the exposure draft of the 37. And in September, we decided that when we issue the re-exposure of the 37, we will expose all our decisions, including the measurement part of our thinking. So you will see in a year's time. So by that time, I will not be on the board, so I don't care about that, though.
Yeah. I think, Tasumi, I think my point is that the comments that you have received from the constituents on IS 37 need to be, I think ISB need to consider those in finalizing the revenue recognition standard. That is what I'm trying to drive at. Because I think you have received a lot of objections in moving that. I mean, whilst I recognize that, you know, the conceptual framework project is ongoing, I think those are the feedback from, you know, the jurisdictions that you cannot ignore.
Oh, okay.
And that specific feedback about saying that probability has a role in sort of as a recognition hurdle before you get to measurement, we have heard in the revenue feedback, on the ED, and therefore we will consider that in redeliberation. And as I said, the issue seems to be, very much in the context in this document about when you've got variable consideration with low probabilities of possibly getting an inflow, feeling that doing a probability weighted calculation in that situation is inappropriate, and you'd be best having no revenue recognition in that situation.
I would like to add one more thing, this revenue recognition project this issue, probability weighted, is not only the liability recognition, but also that the receivables, and once it comes to the receivables, now under financial instrument standards, what we are thinking about the probability weighted could be the best way too. So and we try to be consistent on the asset side, and liability side, so we are still waiting for the 37 discussion. But to be honest, the trouble with the 37 is not only the this kind of probability weighted, but it's sort of the how to deal with the lawsuits or different issues. So I think hopefully we would like to discuss concurrently, but exposure draft cannot be the same timing. So it's unfortunate, but. Yeah, that fact at the moment, I think. So do you have any other views? So if you don't, yes, Tadashi.
Thank you, Tatsumi. I have comments on questions on the non-cash consideration. And the paragraph 46 of ED said that non-cash consideration shall be measured at fair value. No objection. But I have a question, fair value of when? Fair value of the at the time of the contract made, or fair value of the time of the revenue is recognized? Because it is a very big issue, would be very big issue, such as a long-term construction contract that you made a contract in 5 years ago and then revenue recognized in the continuously or at completion of the contract, such as a particular case is IFRIC 12 intangible model, because that entity constructs some infrastructure and then receives that intangible asset to the ability to collect the money from the users. In that case, that the fair value of such intangible items could be differ very to the significant extent. So that's I think the standard should say something about that.
Okay, thank you. So do you have any response, Henry? Pasar.
Yeah, the way the standard is written is the fair value of the non-cash consideration at the time of exchange. That will be similar close to revenue recognition. Having said that, we have heard feedback in terms of time value of money, how complications it could be. So when I take into non-cash consideration, the timing of when I'm going to receive that non-cash consideration versus timing of satisfying performance, it could be complicated to the calculation. We'll probably be considering that as we redeliberate.
Okay, thank you. So now we would like to move to the topic 4, which is onerous performance obligations. So it's very obvious. Sansu, please.
Yes. I think that this is a question of unit of account. Unit of account, I'm sorry. At first, I think the IASB needs to provide a principle of a framework about unit of account. I wonder why the I'd like to go back to topic 2. Why the warranties between replace and repair should be different in terms of the level of unit of account. The replace in case of replacement, the ED requires to recognize, to reflect at the level of obligation of the product, entire product. But in case of repair, the ED requires to reflect at the level of the components of the product. It's different level, but I think, I wonder why it's different. The obligation is to provide the product itself, not other than the components, the parts of the product. But the ED requires differently to treat. I think those issues are related to the unit of account. The issue is not just on only this ED, but the other IFRS has the same issues, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you very much. So, do you have any response, Henry?
Well, just on the warranty issue, I think we were just trying to get at the amount, the appropriate amount of revenue to defer, and just thought that if you had to replace the whole product, then effectively you hadn't, you essentially hadn't delivered what you'd promised to deliver, and therefore you should defer all of the revenue on that product. Whereas if effectively it was going to be it was going to be the components, then you should just defer to the level of the components that were going to be replaced, because that was effectively the extent of your obligation. I think more generally on the warranty, though, I know we haven't discussed it this morning, but and I know that there are comments in the comment letters from participants today that find our whole approach to the warranty sort of overly complex, and we will certainly be looking at that because I think a lot of people find trying to draw the distinction between the defective and the insurance type warranty, the latent defect, sorry, and the insurance type warranty as overly complex. So I think your comment about the different unit account for replacement and repair will get picked up when we reconsider the approach to warranty accounting more generally.
Right, so the issue, say, apart from that issue here is the, say, the onerous part should be recognized as on the basis of the performance obligation or just a contract basis. So do you have any views on this point? Yes, Catherine, please.
In our comment letter, we have said that we would go for the contract level rather than the performance obligation level. Having said that, I've been trying to sort of think through how does that actually work in practice, because I can see why you got to the performance obligation sort of level because of the allocation of revenue, and it all fits quite nicely. In terms of the current approach that we have under IS 18, there's a basic idea of setting aside enough of the revenue to cover the future costs. And I think there's also a sense in terms of just going on a relative fair value basis, are we losing something in the process of looking at that angle? Because chopping it up and saying, okay, I've got something that's onerous here, when actually we've got a full contract that isn't onerous, and there's a commercial reason as to why different components were going in as they were. But overall, it makes sense. Doesn't seem to be the right answer.
Thank you. Do you have any other? Yes, Doctor, yeah, please.
Yeah, in our response to MSB, that is in relation to question 9 of the ED, we have already objected to the probability weighted average in the question 7. And therefore, for the question 9, which is in relation to your topic 4, we do not, when what Christian said, that you chop one contract into separate parts, and you have 10 parts, but nine of the 10 are extremely profitable, but one is not. And then you just bring down the whole thing. So in our response, we say that it's not really appropriate to lump the onerous performance obligation with the overall performance, and especially when you are usually using the probability weighted average method. And as was mentioned previously, earlier on, you say that for a large population of items, it's not an issue. But what happens? You have one unique contract or one unique item, for example. So I think alternative method should be allowed by the final standard rather than just probability weighted average.
Yes, please.
What I want to say is the difference between the build and sell model and sell and build model. I already explained that to Paul, but I want to reiterate here right now. Build and sell and build are very different. Build and sell means that, sell and build, the builder has hold the control. So the builder can change the structure or anything they like to before they sell. But in the second model, sell and build, the builder does not have any control at all. Because there is a contract between the customer and the builder, builder has to follow the obligations. That means that activity-based accounting might be more proper for the sell and build model. And also, if there is a government interference, the obligation for the builder is even stricter. So the builder cannot do more, actually nothing on changing the structures or design of the building at all. Mm-hmm. So that both of those two things, if there is those two things like build and sell and government interference, I think activity-based model might be the approach to recognize the revenue. And also that can be explained with the concept of control. The builder does not have enough control if the model is the build and sell. I mean, sell and build, I'm sorry. And also if there's a government interference.
Can I clarify? So in the relationship with the onerous contract, what kind of implication build and sell and sell and...
There is not much difference in the relationship of the onerous, the construction, the revenue recognition, but, I want to just point out the control, in terms of control. The models from the Europe is very different from the models of the Asian countries.
Sorry, I don't understand. Could you explain in a different way?
Well, in a different way, we just discussed that with Paul during the break. What he said was that in Europe, build and sell is a typical model. But in Asia, sell and build is a typical model. So that there is a very big difference between those two continents, I think. And I think that is not just a difference between the countries, but it can be a kind of model that we can generalize. So sell and build are very different. That's what I want to point out. And also, sell and build has a less control for the builder than the build and sell. And also I want to say is that the government interference gives more power, more control to the customer than government interference at all. That's the point I want to make.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, please.
Thank you. Our view is that onerous tests should be performed at the contract level. I think in many industries, goods and services are often bundled to actually achieve a desired level of return or profitability. And if we do it at the performance obligation level, I think it basically will not reflect the economics of bundled deals. And I think that may also result in a day one loss. And even if we were to push the day one loss and to the point where the performance obligation is satisfied, I think that may result in front loading of profit if the higher profit performance obligation has been satisfied first. And we really do not think that that it's basically decision useful information and that it's appropriate.
Yes, Millie, please. Could you switch off the microphone, please?
I think in the MESB response to ISB, I think we said we agreed with the onerous contract at the performance obligation level based on, I think, the principles of how if revenue is to be allocated at the performance obligation level, then, that model and principle therefore flows. But I think perhaps a higher level question is, why are we accounting for onerous contracts in the revenue standard? Because if we were to take the provision for owner's contracts into IS 37, then we won't be stuck with inconsistent principles and might therefore address quite a lot of the issues that we are talking about here.
Okay, so Henry?
No, that is a comment that we've heard from a few other respondents about why we've done it in the revenue standard. And I think one of the reasons why we did it was to try and get a very converged solution for loss-making revenue contracts. And, you know, the U.S. treatment and IS 37 will be slightly different. I think one of the other drivers for sort of putting it in the revenue proposals was also because when we were looking at this, the time we were looking at this, the board was sort of discussing IS 37 and the measurement. And at that time, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we were in the process of running up to the second exposure draft on IS 37, and the measurement of that under that revised ED would have a margin in there. And I think in the revenue context, most people felt that there shouldn't be a margin included on the owner's performance obligation. It should just be effectively a cost-based measurement. So that's why we took it out of IS 37 and put it in the revenue standard.
That's kind of the background to that. But going forward, would the board consider, you know, now that IS 37, you might be rethinking some of the principles there, whether that therefore the scope, you could put owner's contract back to 37?
I'm sure we will certainly look at it. I mean, there were one or two commentators who actually disagree with the whole basis of having this test, not only disagree with the level at which we're doing it at the performance obligation level, they actually think they disagree with actually having the test in there as well. So we will be looking at it and the whole question about where it goes. But almost all people who have commented on this topic think that we're doing the test at too low a level and it should be done at the contract level or even above the contract level in certain cases.
Okay, so do you have any views on this topic 4? Oh yes, Tadashi, please.
The issue in the owner's contract based on the performance obligation basis or contract basis, I have some sympathy on the contract basis measurement, because that paragraph 24, when the performance obligation is distinguished in the contract, the paragraph 24 is allow that the entity to do not distinguish the performance obligation if those obligation is accomplished in the same time. So that's a requirement to the performance obligation basis in the owner's contract cases, because it's something artificially some cases the performance itself is quite distinguishable, but they can allow to the getting together to the performance obligation in the timing of the services or goods delivered. So that's and that's basis I do support some contract. I can say that remaining performance obligation as a whole in a single contract, because in more cases some performance obligation has already performed and should be based on the remaining performance obligation as a whole in a contract.
So thank you. So if there is no other views on the topic 4, we would like to move to today we have covered only 4 topics. So the remaining 15 minutes, if you have any other aspect of the exposure draft, we would like to hear from you. Yes, please, Dr. Yap, please.
I just want to get one out of my chest. This BC 62, paragraph C, I just want to know, please tell me, please give me the answer today. Receive benefit. And specifically say receive the economic benefit. Could you tell me that economic benefit must be in financial or in other benefits, non-financial and financial? Because this economic benefit, it is understood as financial. because we're talking about financial reporting, unless you talk about economic income, where you have some psychic benefits other than financial benefits. So I'd like to seek clarification on this aspect. And the second thing is that I would like to urge the board, please look at the generic development, development of the generic control principle at the at a conceptual level, so that the individual so-called control principle can be modified at the individual standard level. Because at the moment, what we have, what I've seen is that ISB has adopted a very ad hoc basis of developing certain principle, and the risk and reward have been conveniently put aside and used again in other ED like leases. But on the other hand, control principle is very much the key principle to be used. And it seems that it is the future direction of the development of your future standard. So I really would like to urge the board, please consider this. Develop a generic control principle so that it can be applied consistently for the rest of the new standards.
Paul?
To respond to the first part of your question, I think the answer is economic benefits. It's similar to the issue the board is debating in the consolidation standard. The person who gets control must also have some benefit before you can say control has passed. I can take my inventory and put it in a storage warehouse, but the people who own the warehouse don't really have any benefit from that other than getting the storage fee. And so I have not passed control in the sense of recognizing revenue. On your second point, I think it's very well taken. I think we have multiple concepts of control. It's been most elaborated on in the consolidation project, but then we use it slightly differently here in the revenue ED. We use it differently in related party transactions, whether you're a key management person and you can control. And I think at least either we need to have a consistent definition of control or possibly find another term in the context of revenue recognition. I agree with you.
Okay, so thank you. So
clarification to your first question, your answer to my first questions. So it is taken as financial benefits or not? Because you still use the word economic, which is quite ambiguous to me, because you can take as an accounting profit or economic profit, because economists will have different notion altogether, because they are just nuisance to me.
Okay, I don't really know how to answer that then. I think I thought it's economic subsumes financial. But I'm not sure. But
for example, if I'm a salesman to a charity body, okay? Sell a product to a charity organization. Okay? And what benefit would that subscribe in that transactions? A charity not gonna use sell product to them and they're not gonna use it to make profits, but it's for their own use or charitable for charity. But is that an economic benefit? That's what I'm trying.
I would think so.
But I think we were trying to capture that notion in there. But I think it comes back to your point earlier on about the language, about the cash flow there. But I read the rest of that paragraph would capture that example that you've just given there at the end of paragraph BC62.
Okay, so do you have any other views? Yes, Millie, please.
Could the board just have a look, relook at the amount of disclosures required by the ED? They are overly detailed, and whether on the balance of things, it is really required for usefulness of financial information.
That's definitely a common theme that we're hearing about the level of the disclosure requirements and whether we can find some way of tying them better up to the principle. And certain specific disclosures have caused particular concerns. And so we will be looking carefully at that. So some way of sort of streamlining them that they perhaps become more targeted and focused.
Okay, so your comment is a general comment on the disclosure, not specific? Okay, yeah, thank you. Yes, Catherine.
In terms of sort of the overall issues that we've had here, I think what's very important is field testing against actual real fact patterns and quite common ones of figuring out, okay, how do we think it should be applied in those sort of situations, and is it clear and obvious how we get to those sort of answers? I think it's very important. And that includes looking at some of the interpretations that we've got out there at the moment. I mean, I'm thinking particularly 631 on barter transactions for websites and going back to the point about sort of fair valuing, is that enough to just to bring in revenue? And looking at what is a real transaction if you've not got cash moving around the place.
Yeah, I think that the staff has in mind to the what you have suggested, I think. So do you have any other views? Yes, Tadashi?
I have a comment. As it is also included in my comment letter. I'm not happy with the terminology with the performance obligation as defined in this ED, that because that the word and performance is quite different from the dictionary meaning, that in the performance obligation in these standards is just a means that obligation to deliver goods and services to the customer, or transfer the goods and service to the customers. But usually, performance is a slightly different meaning. It's used in just the verb of the performance, perform or performing. Something performance means that may imply that level of the services, the quality of services in the everyday language or economic literature. For example, I have a daughter, and she goes to school, and school obligation, the performance obligation, in this exposure draft, they give a lecture to my daughters. It is a performance obligation as defined in this exposure draft, but real performance of the school is how to educate the students and how my the daughters is get the knowledge, or it is a performance of the context. So that's my suggestion, to change the word or something different use. I don't quite not happy with that use of the performance, because it's usually also that like a performance reporting, performance auditing is some kind of the reference or usable term is very commonly used even in the financial reporting community. It may create a confusion of the people. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your point. So do you have any suggestions of the wording?
I think that delivery obligation is one of the candidate, and also the performing obligation could be acceptable for the rather than performance obligation, because the performance is particularly means that something like a quality of a level of service or what is achievement of that.
Okay, thank you very much. So, yes, Prasada.
Catherine, you had mentioned about field testing. At the NAWAC roundtables, we heard from a lot of the participants about we would need to field test the model. So I'll be interested in the other participants over here. Do you guys share similar views as Catherine in terms of whether do we need to field test the proposed requirements?
I totally agree with Catherine, because revenue is such a pervasive topic. And it impacts on every company, every entity. So we cannot afford a standard that works well in one part of the atmosphere, but in the southern hemisphere it doesn't work, because there's what we call convergence.
Okay, so thank you very much. Oh, yes, Catherine, please.
Can I just add quickly to that? I mean, in terms of speed of implementation, there's a separate consultation out there about asking how long does it take to implement standards. In terms of the longest time that it takes to implement a standard can be arguing over what the standard means and how it should be applied in a certain situation, and what did the people mean when they wrote that, and what's important and what isn't. And that, I think we've heard this morning, there's been a year of arguing in Malaysia over IFRIC 15. That's where all the time comes. So that the more effort that is put in up front in making sure that this thing is reasonably obvious in some reasonably common situations, and there will always be the unusual. We're not expecting sort of all the answers, but we at least need to know the fundamentals of where we're heading on this so that we can deal with the unusual when we come across them.
Yeah, thank you very much. So regarding the effective date, so we have already issued a consultation document, and we are waiting for your views. Its deadline is end of January, so you have plenty of time to think about it. So could you let us know your views on this issue? So do you have any other views? So that means you are very much supportive of other part of the exposure draft? Yeah, okay. So I think so. Now we are on a schedule. So thank you very much for your cooperation. So I think that today we spent a lot of time on first topic one, and we understand where the issues exist. Based on your input, we will think about what we should do. Obviously, our target date is end of June 2011. So towards that goal, we will work very hard. If you have any other views or input, say any time, we are very much delighted to have your views. So do you have any views, last thing? Okay, I think that the very last moment, we would like to have the chairman of the Malaysian Accounting Standards Board. Trustees of the... I made a mistake. So could we have your views? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tatsumi Yamada-san, and fellow ISB, FASB members, fellow trustees of our Financial Reporting Foundation and MASB directors. First of all, a word from our Ministry of Tourism. Welcome to Malaysia and Kuala Lumpur. I'm an advisor to the ministry, so I must get my plug in as well. We really appreciate the presence today of representatives from ISB, Tatsumi, Paul Pachter, Henry Rees, and from MASB, Sri Prasad Chadambi, especially to Henry and Prasad, whom I understand has come a very, very long way to be with us today. We also like to welcome the delegates from Australia, Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, Singapore, Malaysia, and participants from IPSAS and IFAAS. On behalf of the country host, I like to express appreciation to the panelists from ISB and FASB for sharing with us their thoughts today, and of course also listening to our thoughts. This shows both boards' seriousness on the question of convergence. Personally, we were encouraged by the rather robust discussion that took place this morning. We felt that issues that were raised were very, very pertinent, particularly on the accounting treatment for real estate and the possibility of use of percentage of completion, which is, of course, a concern in the ASOC region. The speed of globalization these days shows us how imperative it is to have a global accounting standards for greater transparency and comparability. As I speak, SGX is already proposing a merger with ASX, and who knows what else will come next. The world is getting smaller from the time when I first started studying accounting. Standard setters' role is, of course, to shape the future landscape of accounting standards so that the world's capital markets and other users make sound economic decisions that should be taken seriously. So in this respect, I applaud ISB and FASB for their continuous efforts to engage stakeholders and key players. As chairman of the Malaysian Financial Reporting Foundation, I look forward to more outreach programs by ISB and possibly FSB with the various stakeholders to better manage convergence on the international fora. So thank you very much. I won't hold you up much longer. Thank you very much for coming to Malaysia. I will see you again, I hope. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. We are very delighted to make a contribution to your economy by being here. So, and per se, so say, I would like to express my gratitude to the Malaysian Accounting Standards Board. They are arranging this meeting. So, and thank you very much. And also that for the participants, thank you for preparing for today. And also that for observers, so all the way to Malaysia to come and to listen what we are talking about. We are very pleased we can draw such an interest on the revenue recognition. Okay, so this is the end of the discussion. Thank you very much.